Now, if you were lucky enough to be at Clonmel Junction Arts Festival yesterday, you might have come across the artists Anne Cleary and Dennis Connolly, currently touring Ireland on the River Shannon in their solar-powered eco-showboat, which is called the Mayfly. The idea behind this tour is to bring together artists, scientists and the public to raise awareness about the climate crisis and to offer inspiration. Anne and Dennis have commissioned 20 artists, including Alan Phelan and Anne McLeod, to make work on the subject. They completed the first stage of their journey from Limerick to Clonmacnoise in May. They're about to set sail again from Banagher up to Enniskillen. They are usually based in Paris. I'm delighted to say that they're with me in studio this evening. I just love the idea of this journey on a boat where I presume, Dennis, it's all about slowing things right down and looking at what's happening around you and all of that mindfulness that we speak about. I suppose at one level that's what you're doing, but I guess there's a whole load of other things happening as well.
Exactly. It is that slowing down would have been the original idea, that we could slow down enough that we could actually see what's going on around us. It's a solar electric boat, so it doesn't move very, very fast. In any case, boats don't move very fast. So I think 5 knots would be around about our maximum speed. And we're going against the current upriver. We've slowed down, we found we haven't slowed down enough. We thought at this stage we'd have filmed a kingfisher, but we haven't been moving slow enough to even see the kingfisher. So we're hoping in July we'll get to do that. And we've had some ideas about that, slowing right down so we can see some of the stuff.
And you could give us a sense of exactly what was involved over the weekend in Clonmel, what these Eco Sundays are about, because there'll be a series of those in different venues as you make your way up the Shannon.
That's right, Sean. Clonmel this Sunday, Eco Sunday in Clonmel this week was just fantastic. Actually, it was probably the best we've done because everything came together really, really nicely. We had, a pavilion, an outdoor space called the Pangolin Pavilion, which is a dome made of umbrellas, recycled.
And explain pangolin to me, exactly what we're talking about there, because okay, so I went looking at it online today to see what it actually meant.
So the pangolin is a little creature that is, it's like an armadillo. He's an armed creature, so he's got overlaid scales and he curls up in a ball to protect himself. So he's quite beautiful, and also he was blamed for the pandemic, unfortunately, because the Chinese, he's a delicacy in China. So we constructed a dome out of overlapping umbrellas. And oddly, it looks very like the pangolin with his overlaid scales. So we called it the Pangolin Pavilion.
Yeah. So that's quite a big structure, obviously.
It's not that big. It's about 6 meters in diameter. We can get about 15 or 20 people seated on the ground on rugs or on mats, listening to a speaker in that pavilion. So the idea is it's a little bit like a travelling Bedouin tent, an intimate space where people sit down and chat and converse. And so we're inviting people, we've invited poets, we've invited scientists, other artists to talk about their work related to climate change into that space. And then outdoors, around about the space, we have various workshops going on to do with biodiversity. So we have a wonderful marine biologist, Rachel O'Malley, who does a kick sample. She goes and she kicks the local stream and gathers little microinvertebrates.
And what is kick an ecological term now? What exactly does kick the stream mean? I'm sure it doesn't do it any damage.
No, it's kick sample is a scientific term. A person goes in wearing waders, preferably, and kicks the rocks up and then uses a net to gather what comes out. And the what you see in there, what invertebrates you gather, are indicators of the quality of the water.
Okay, so there's a lot of science going on here, but the bit that struck me when I looked, one of the things that struck me today when I was looking online, Dennis, was the picture of the Mayfly, the boat itself. And we're going to tweet an image of the Mayfly now on our own Twitter handle, which is @RTE Arena. What a colourful vessel this is.
Yeah, it started. It's a fiberglass boat, a small yacht, and like most yachts, it would have been white fiberglass with a red hull. And we took it this winter, and we painted it using paints that you usually use for surfboards. So we turned it into a work of art, and of course, we've also got a flag to represent the Mayfly, which was designed by two collaborating artists, Deirdre Power and Chelsea Canavan, who we gave the commission to create the flag.
And that flag representing the Mayfly, we're talking about the Mayfly that would be used for fishing.
Exactly.
How much of that? Well, obviously we're now in July, but were you on the water at the time when the Mayfly would have been there?
And not only that, but we have two other artists, Anna McLeod and Porrig Cunningham, who have been working specifically on filming the Mayfly on Loch Key. And we haven't seen what they filmed yet, but they were out in May when the Mayfly were out. But we came across Mayfly in Scariff, and we took some macro photographs of them. So the Mayfly is used for fishing, but it's also an indicator of species. If the Mayfly is there, it means that the water is clean. So that's really what we're interested in,
yes,
is that indication of clean water.
In terms of the boat itself, which of you is the of the big smile coming on Dennis's face even before I finish the question? Which of you is the boat maniac? It's you, Dennis, is it?
Yeah, so I would have grown up close to Dunleary Harbour, and every summer my parents sent me down to get sailing lessons, and in the winter I crewed on a small cruiser in the evening, belonging to a man who's long dead now, on a wooden boat. And I did develop quite a passion for boats, but sailing boats, really.
The mix that you have here, Anne, of I suppose, artistic activity, you know, the design of the boat, the look of the boat itself, as much as anything else, and those flags and those various artistic events and inputs that will be happening in the various venues along the way. How important is that, the mix between that, the artistic activity, and I suppose the more campaigning side or activist side of what you're doing?
I think it's all really, really important. So Dennis and I come from an architectural background. We studied architecture originally, and architecture is it's like the real mix of art and science, actually. It's engineering mixed with design. But in our personal lives, for many years, we've both been engaged as activists with regard to climate change in Paris. So I would have spent many, many evenings handing out flyers for Europe Ecologie. And Dennis volunteered to film the climate gathering in 2014. Yeah. So we have always been involved in that aspect of climate activism personally. And this is the first time we've actually made a mix. And so, you know, it's an opportunity really for us finally, that now that our children are big and they've grown up and we're independent.
You're off the boat by yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
By yourself.
Yeah.
And what do you think, Dennis, what do you think art can achieve in this area? I mean, let's face it, the human race has not done well in this area, it would have to be said. What do you think art can do that perhaps other activities, political activity, straightforward activism, can't achieve?
No, we were talking about that with Deirdre O'Mahony yesterday. In fact, just the fact that artists, a particular talent that we have, is to make connections between people. We listen to science. We engage with communities. We are interested in problems all around us, in local problems, in universal problems, and we're willing to accept that we're not experts, that we're just people who make connections, really. And I think that's what almost all of the 20 artists that we have working with us, that's what they do. They're giving us connections with communities, with scientific ideas, with artistic ideas, with ecological, local ecological problems. And I think that is unique to artists, is that we are engaged, really.
Yeah. Who was it that made the sound clip that I'm about to listen? Was that the two of you that made the recordings? No.
That's Aaron Murphy and Mick O'Shea,
right.
Who are sound artists and very interesting artists. They live in Cork, and they also do food art under the name Domestic Godless.
Mm-hmm. With another artist called Stephen Brands.
That's right, And Mick and Irene came to Clonmac Noise, and they spent 3 or 4 days just in that area recording the sounds of the site.
I just want to listen to some of it. So most of what we're hearing is actual sound in and around the area where they were near Clonmac Noise, yeah?
Yeah.
It would be, a lot of it would be generated by that, but a lot of it would have been
treated in some way.
A lot of it was live sound. They wove wires and cords around the boat and around the site to make some of those sounds. Mm-hmm.
Vibrations.
So there was a sculpture installation.
They had microphones in water. Amazing.
And sent bubbles through water.
Yeah, and it just I'll just play another little section of it there so we get a sense of it. No question, but that's a sound of Clonmac Noise that perhaps we haven't heard. And the sound artists, as you said there, Mick O'Shea and Irene Murphy, Dennis, you were describing some of the processes. Even they put microphones down into the water to get some of those sounds. Yeah.
There's microphones in water. There was foam being created from river water. There was cables stretched to vibrate in the wind, the way you would do with an Aeolian harp. And then there was a lot of electronic processing that nobody would really understand except for them.
Yeah. So you start in Banagher. How long will it take you to make that journey up to Enniskillen? Or am I asking you how long is a piece of string?
No. It's very set out and very time coordinated.
I suppose you have to, if you want your Eco Sundays, you have to be in the venue on the Sunday.
That's it, exactly. So we're travelling from Banagher this Sunday right up to Enniskillen over about 6 weeks. I think our final date in Enniskillen is it the 16th?
The 21st of August.
So we're taking our time between each venue. So, you know, we're traveling really, really slowly and we can meet people along the way as well. Mm. So we have our precise dates, and then we've a week in between just to relax and meet people.
Tell me a little bit about the Ardna Crusha lock, because you started down in Limerick, obviously at the mouth of the river, as it were, and you made your way up. The Ardna Crusha lock is quite a dramatic one, I believe.
It's quite dramatic, yeah. And you know, it was one of the themes that we explored. We had an engineer, Tom Cosgrove, who's a professor of engineering in UL, who spoke to the public about the history of this project, which was one of the things we wanted to point out, you know, that was at the beginning of the Irish Free State. They invested in this huge project, which is a fifth of our
clean energy, long before anybody heard that term clean energy.
Absolutely.
I guess,
and I mean, you know, it's somewhat controversial, hydroelectricity, but it is clean.
You'd have to look at what's happening to the river in the process of all
exactly,
of that as well.
Yeah, and we did consider that as well, you know, and we talked about that, but it was a fifth of the state's budget at the time. And
so how far up did you rise in the Ardna Crusha lock?
I think it was 100 feet. And, you know, when you're at, which doesn't sound that dramatic, but when you're at the bottom of this concrete and steel
So basically you were 100 metres down.
100 feet.
100 feet, yeah, yeah, 100 yeah, feet down, in effect, underwater with walls of steel and rock around you.
Yeah.
Then
yeah.
the water fills up and you rise up.
And you rise up,
If you go the 100 feet.
Yeah, with a lot of concrete and rust and dripping water all around you.
I'd say you were glad to kind of find yourself level with the river and able to continue on your journey upstream. Just a question that's come into us there too, which is interesting. This is from @TT Newbridge is the Twitter handle. Siobhan Parker, in fact, it is. Loving the sight and sound of the @Eco Showboat. Would #Liffey and #Newbridge be deep enough to allow a visit? Now, obviously, you're not going to divert across at this moment, but could you do it in other rivers, other places?
So there's there's a limited number of rivers that are navigable, but we have we have a trailer for the Mayfly, which is a small enough boat to put on a trailer. So we can hopefully we'll be able to bring it to waterways that are not on the inland waterways, which is what we're navigating at the moment.
And we also have a second boat, the 48M, which is a barge, a big 60-foot barge that we're planning to turn into an eco showboat hopefully next year, and that is specifically for the canals and for the Liffey.
Yeah, I'd be able to do that. You can think of it along the Royal Canal, I suppose, when you talk about a barge in that fashion, although there are other rivers that could take it too. Ash, your life is planned out for you now. That's it for sure. That's it. Anne Cleary and Dennis Connolly with me this evening, and if you want to find out more information about the various venues for the eco boat, you go to schoolofloking.org. I love that website name, schoolofloking.org. Now, this weekend, the theatre world mourned the passing of and celebrated the life of the great director Peter Brook, who died at the age of 97. In 1970, his production of A Midsummer's Night Dream for the Royal Shakespeare Company, and then in 1963 also, his film Lord of the Flies were hugely influential. There was also a controversial staging of Strauss's Salome with sets by Salvador Dali for the Royal Opera House. However, his contribution to theatre in the latter half of the 20th century and his approach to theatrical direction went far beyond his native British shores. He was universally lauded for his innovative approach to direction, and in 1970, Peter Brook co-founded the International Centre for Theatre Research, a multinational company of actors, dancers, musicians and others, which is now based in Paris. In his groundbreaking 1968 book, The Empty Space, Brook said, "I can take any empty space and call it a bare stage. A man walks across this empty space while someone else is watching him, and this is all that is needed for an act of theatre to be engaged." As a director, Peter Brook was most noted for his minimalist theatrical philosophy. And in this 2013 clip, he is speaking with the American interviewer Charlie Rose. He articulates how this approach developed within him as his career progressed.
I started with a love of trying out everything, and in life and in the theatre, excess. Yeah. And I plunged into excess and then tried to do it as best I could, but I used every known scenic, musical, staging device known. And as I tried that over the years, but it's a long, long process. My God, you know, I came to Broadway, I did musicals. I mean, I tried, always avoided the snobbery of categorizing, and nobody said to me, "Ah, your way, your theory of simplicity." I gradually found, just practically, that the human being is richer than the greatest stage effects that exist. So gradually, I began to see, well, we don't need that. We don't need that. In fact, you have to have, I'm afraid, a young director is unwise if he doesn't live through the same experience and by trial and error discover what today, in relation to what he's doing, is better if it's simpler. But you have to discover that to love it and believe in it.
That's the late theatre director Peter Brook, who died on Saturday at the age of 97. And if you're interested in finding out more about Peter Brook's contribution to theatre, we're going to tweet a link to a public interview with Brook for the RT Radio 1 show In the Wings, which was presented by John Kelly. This was in October 2007. The interview formed part of the 50th Dublin Theatre Festival at the time, and Peter Brook reflected on the human mystery of acting, the healing process of theatre, his love of cowboy films and the artistry of the Marx Brothers. So lots to be found there. As I said, it's on the RTE website in the podcast section, and we will tweet a link from our own page at RTE Arena. And if you want to follow up on that, you can. A socially awkward inventor and hoarder living alone in a remote part of Wales comes up with a foolproof plan to amuse himself and in turn combat his isolation. Comedian David Earle's comedic creation of Brian is a character fans of Ricky Gervais's series Extras and Afterlife will recognise. But in this new feature film, Brian and Charles, we see a new aspect of Brian's life. The film recently won the Audience Award at the London edition of the Sundance Film Festival. It stars David Earle as Brian and his comedy partner Chris Hayward as Brian's robot bestie, Charles, who he makes entirely out of household items. Brian and Charles started out on internet radio, successfully transitioned onto stage, and perhaps a bawdier form than we now see on screen. I spoke to David Earle and Chris Hayward recently about Brian and Charles, which opens in cinemas this weekend. But before we hear that conversation, let's have a clip from the film. Here is David Earle as Brian, a man with a plan.
I'm building a robot. I don't know what I didn't think of it before. Be very, very, very handy. Strong, fast, agile. Can help me lift things around the house. I just take inspiration from stuff around me, you know, anything, absolutely anything. That could be his ankle, hand. I'll just look around me and I go, what can I use? What can I use? Belly button.
I've always wanted to build one. It's always been a scratch I've wanted to itch. Scratch, scratch, scratch. Like Mr. Williams over there. I mean, who wouldn't want to build one, eh? Who wouldn't want to build one? Huh? What do they call it? Artificial intelligence. That's it.
AI.
Huh?
AI.
AI? What?
AI.
AI? AI! AI. Artificial intelligence.
Yeah,
yeah, I know.
David, let's start with the character of Brian and his origins in stand-up, actually. Yeah?
Yeah. In fact, Brian performed at the Dublin Comedy Festival in the, what's the gardens? In
the Ivy Gardens?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was on with David O'Doherty and, anyway, I've forgotten. But so I started stand-up about 12, 13 years ago because I was advised to. So I made a couple of short, really rough short films, and some Ricky Gervais saw them, liked them, but I was advised to get out there and show my face. And, oh, okay. So I'd always wanted to do stand-up. I loved Harry Hill, but I was so nervous. But I did that for a few years, and then I did an internet radio show. It was like the world's worst phone-in host, where I'd struggle to converse with people ringing out members of the public. And then Rupert, the producer of Brian and Charles, rang up one night and was too shy to talk. So he used this software, and that's how Brian and Charles were born. And then Chris was listening, and he was desperate to make Charles.
Yeah, so the conversation between them was so funny because it was this weird computer software program that would read out sentences in weird ways. And so I just loved it. And so we started doing a live show together where I would be dressed as Charles, David would be Brian, and Rupert, our producer, was sat at the back typing away on Charles's voice. So we developed that over 2 or 3 years. We had them doing songs on stage. And yeah, it was a bit of a chaotic stage show that we were trying to shape.
Dressed as Charles is an interesting way of putting it, Chris. It's not high-end costuming, let's face it, is it?
Oh, okay.
He's having a dig.
Yeah, I thought it was. Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a weird, I don't know what you call it, puppet, costume, puppet, stroke, cardboard box, essentially. So we'd be doing that, and it was slightly ridiculous. I mean, it was quite funny seeing people's reactions when we did on stage, because often they'd just be completely baffled and wonder what on earth we were trying to do.
We did one gig in Brighton where we'd been on stage for about half an hour, and apparently some woman leant into her husband and said, I think there's someone in that.
Yeah, like she thought it was a robot, which is mind-blowing.
Yeah.
And we ended up making the short film purely to get something online because we weren't really doing many gigs anymore. We thought, oh, you know what, I think maybe that's it. So we made the short.
I looked at that short film, and I've watched the movie itself, obviously, and it really struck me, particularly in the case of Brian, who people may know from Afterlife and from Extras as well, you know, and he can be rather foul-mouthed and fairly difficult to handle at times, let's face it. But here we get a sense of this lonely guy. We get a real sense of the human being. That transfer from, I suppose, from the stand-up routines where you're looking for the laughs all the time to the film format and this storytelling,
did it get you in under the skin of Brian in a way that you hadn't done in those other
manifestations? Yeah, I guess so. I mean, and Ricky's writing Afterlife, so there is a version of the character that he enjoys me performing. I mean, I enjoy it as well. I love simulating sex in a caravan and stuff. But when we did this, we wanted to make it family friendly, and we kind of had Wallace and Gromit in mind and sort of live action Pixar, and we just wanted to make him a bit more what we felt was likable.
Picture frame, carpet, curtains, old potato, plugs, shoes, plant pot.
How do you know all this stuff? You've read the dictionary?
Yes, I have.
When?
When you were snoozing. You were snoozing, and I was reading. Alex Andrew.
I beg your pardon?
Your name is Alex Andrew.
No, my name's not Alex Andrew. No, no, no. My name's Brian. Brian. Brian, yeah.
Brian.
No, no, you're not Brian. No, 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 no. No, I'm Brian.
Brian.
You like me to give you a name? Huh? Tony? Oh, he didn't like Tony. Tony the robot? Clive?
No.
Charles?
Charles.
Charles?
Charles.
Charles? Charles, you like Charles?
Charles Petrescu.
You want that name, do you? Charles Petrescu. All right, then.
I'm Charles Petrescu. Hello, Brian.
Hello, Charles. It's lovely to meet you.
I am your friend.
I'm your friend too.
I also, I mean, maybe I'm pushing it a bit, but you know, these two were a bit like Beckett characters to me. They were like two tramps from a Beckett play. That kind right. of, and the ideas around loneliness and isolation are the stuff that comes up all the time, Chris.
Yeah, I guess we didn't really, it was just like a long process really to work out exactly what their journey was going to be. And the isolation, loneliness thing just came out of that exploration, I suppose, of the characters, but also the setting, because the where we filmed it, it can look really isolating and bleak. And I think that adds to the lonely nature of Brian, yeah.
But the other thing is, I mean, at a certain point, your character, Chris, Charles, as the AI, the artificial intelligence, albeit a cardboard box with a mannequin's head on the top of it, but nevertheless, he asked questions like, you know, does it stop at the tree? You know, does the world end at the tree? He asks questions like, can birds do what they want? Which are big philosophical questions when you think about
them. I can't
answer
that. Can you?
Yeah.
Oh.
Can they?
Yeah, I don't think Attenborough even knows. Can birds do what they want?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it started off with him being slightly childlike. I guess kids do ask those sort of questions sometimes that throw you and you go, oh, I don't know what the answer is to that, that question. So yeah, it's childlike stroke deep philosopher. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, we had a lot of fun coming up with those lines.
So. Yeah, but I wonder too, David, in terms of actually playing the characters on screen, and yeah, I know you've played a version of Brian before on screen, but this is very different. It's coming from you and Chris. You're creating more of a character, more of a human being really behind the funny guy or the odd guy that he is. How frightening, you said you were frightened of stand-up. How frightened were you of the acting process and what might be demanded of you there?
Oh, yeah, I'm really frightened. I mean, with 2 months to go, I think I WhatsApped the group and said, how'd you feel if I pulled out?
I was amazed that he turned up. I was half expecting to get a text saying, I'm not coming.
Yes, because I've never done any acting training, I don't know what's right and what's wrong. And so you have to go with your gut and trust, and obviously Jim at the monitor. But because I just don't know, it's like, let's just get someone else in who does know and keep it simple.
You actually thought at one stage about casting somebody else in the role, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I was petrified. So I was like, let's get a proper actor in.
Yeah, well, like, yeah. No, it has to be you.
Right.
Okay. And tell the truth now, Chris. Did you ever think, I want somebody else in underneath that cardboard box. Do you know what I'm going to do? While we're talking, I'm going to tweet an image of the character of Charles so that people know what we're talking about. I don't know. What height is he? 6.5, 7 foot tall?
Oh, he's about seven. Yeah, well, I'm about 6'1". So when I have the box and the mat and the head, he's pushing 7 foot.
He's a basketball player, isn't he?
Yeah, he'd be great in basketball. Except his one arm doesn't work really well.
I can see the follow-up to Brian and Charles has been written as we speak. What are the physical challenges, you know, because you are in underneath that box and I presume, are you manipulating the head? Are you speaking in there and your voice being treated some way or do you dub it afterwards?
It's dubbed afterwards. I'd sometimes, depending where the location was, I'd sometimes say the lines, especially if we were outside, I'd say the lines. If we were indoors, we sometimes had his lines pre-recorded on this computer software. Or Rupert, our producer, would also improvise writing out certain lines. So it's a combination of that, really, but it's all dubbed in post with this weird electronic voice.
And we could change the lines right up to the last moment, couldn't we? If we felt like, oh, I don't know, if we got bored of a line, we just wanted to try and make it funnier.
Yes, that was really helpful. We had the advantage of being able to change his dialogue right up into the final sound mix. Yeah. But practically, it's almost like being blindfolded. You can't really see anything in there. So I'd have to just listen to a lot of direction from Jim, even things in terms of which way his head is looking, that sort of thing.
Yeah, we should say the Jim that we're talking about that we keep mentioning is Jim Archer, the director. I mean, he must have been vital to the whole process, David, because it was he that put together the short as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, we'd written the script and Rupert, you knew Jim, didn't you? I hadn't met Jim before, but yeah, Jim got on board and did such a lovely job of it that, yeah.
Yeah, he'd already made some really brilliant short films that we all liked. And going into it, what was really brilliant was that we were all friends. Like, I think it's quite rare when the writer, performers, director and producer are all mates. And it just meant we're on the same wavelength, really. We found the same things funny. So it just made it easier to, overcome problems when they happened.
But you also open up to us in it, between, and this is in both of you in the writing and particularly in your performance, David, as Brian, you open up this little community, the good and the bad in that little community. And I'm not spoiling anything to say the bully gets his comeuppance. Was that kind of bullying, again, is a very serious topic. And while we're kind of laughing at some of what happens in the film, there is a very serious side to that. Was that important to you to treat that with, you know, the import that I suppose it deserves?
Yeah, I mean, when we think about ideas for the film, we felt like Brian needed to have a threat out there in the outside world. And we were chatting about what would that be in that community. And you'd grown up in that kind of environment. And
yeah, I guess in the countryside, as various characters you meet along the way. We thought of it a little bit like a fairy tale as well. In the fairy tale, you have like the baddie and the goodie sort of thing. So not as simplistic as that, but that was kind of in our mind to think of it as a fairy tale. Yeah, I guess the message was, stand up for yourself ultimately.
But when we did the casting for Eddie, Jamie came in and...
So he's played by Jamie Mitchell. Sorry, go ahead.
He was just so quietly... aggressive and so real and so understated and not try hard, and we just leant in and went, oh, who's this bloke? And actually performing opposite him, genuinely fearful, because I was never quite sure what he'd do. Like there'll be times we're like, oh right, he's just spat by my foot, okay. And, pushed me out of the blue, and so I'd never quite sure around Jamie what he was going to do.
He went pretty method,
so I wasn't acting, I was just crapping myself.
Genuinely frightened.
The other
lovely relationship that's built is the character of Hazel, played by Louise Brealey. I mean, gorgeous dynamic that grows between Brian and Hazel. Again, I suppose there's this sense that it's okay if you're the odd guy or the odd woman. Just be yourself. That's kind of the big message here, really.
Yeah, I think it is, really, yeah. And if you're a bit quirky, just accept that you are and it's fine.
I'm guessing that when they're on stage in the comedy club scenario, we get a much bawdier, much coarser side to both characters.
We had a moment in the live show where we kissed. Charles and Brian kissed. You wouldn't have liked that.
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't know if I did. We were running out of ideas, I think, at that point. Some sort of a kiss. I don't know, it's just your happens.
I don't know. There's a big hug in the film that is, I think, filled with genuine emotion.
Yeah.
I put to you, David Earle.
Yeah. Do you know what? That scene, I was kind of struggling how to play it, how far to go with it. And Lou said to me, just do what Charles is doing. He's doing nothing. And you just project, you know, the audience would project their feelings onto the puppet or onto. So I thought, oh yeah, Charles is a really good actor.
Yeah, he doesn't his expression doesn't change.
Yeah.
But you can sort of see different emotions in him, weirdly.
Yeah, but like members of the crew would say, God, look how sad Charles is there, or look how happy he is there. And he's just
very cheeky.
Yeah. Yeah,
I guess it is. He's the ultimate example of, you know, less is more.
Yeah.
There really is very little that you can do. But it, and I believed that it was a character. I didn't think, Chris Hayward's in underneath that cardboard box, just pretending he's a robot. You know, so less is more.
That was the one sort of worry, although it was quite kind of a thrill as well. When we were filming on set, Chris would come on to do a scene and I would look at him thinking, jeepers creepers, how have we got the funding for this? Like, how have they let us get away with this?
Yeah, and also thinking, are people going to believe that that is a robot and not just see it as me in a weird cardboard box?
But we wanted to keep that, though. We wanted to feel like you had to see the human legs a bit. We wanted the audience to go, that is just a bloke in a box, but I'm going to go with it, yeah.
You kind of do. What kind of reception, has it been getting? I know you've played at Sundance. It strikes me as it's the sort of film that will do really well in the festival circuit and hopefully with for audiences as well.
It's just been a surprise. Every step has just been like, oh, okay, brilliant. Now that's happened. And it's so far it's gone down well in America as well, which I was quite surprised at, because it often feels very British and you wonder if that will translate overseas.
I was joking earlier on when I said I can hear the sequel to Brian and Charles being written as we speak, but there must be in both of you, given the success of it, given the kind of response it's getting, you must think there's a further life in this version of these two characters. Chris first, then you, David.
Yeah, quite possibly, yeah. I mean, we have talked about what a sequel or a follow-up or TV or whatever, what that would involve. I think just to have that opportunity again would be fun, because coming up with the ideas, even if they never make it to the screen, is part of the fun of the process.
And for you, David, do you think there's more in it?
I hope so, if we can find that story that we care about enough to write it. But I think we'd all be hungry to have a go at the comedy again, for sure, and hang out as friends, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, Chris Hayward, less is more actor, and David Earle, actor and comedian. Both of you guys, listen, thanks a million for talking to us today, and congrats again on the film.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Earle and Chris Hayward there in talking to me about Brian and Charles, which goes on general release in cinemas this weekend. We'll be reviewing it on Thursday's programme. Shameless is a sexually frank documentary that responds to the findings of a social research project from NUI Maynooth that looks at cultural and sexual risk in the gay male sexual world of Ireland today. It asks if gay male sexual culture is becoming more experimental because gay men are now often embraced as model citizen consumers. Shot in Dublin's Boiler House sauna, Shameless shows Dublin's queer underbelly, features characters like Lady Kay, Carl Hayden, Vicky Curtis and Stephen Fay. And Stephen Fay is the stage persona of Stephen Quinn, who's with me in studio this evening. Good to have you here, Stephen.
Thanks for having me.
It's a docufilm, I think is how you're describing Shameless. Will you tell us how it came out of, grew out of this research, this academic research?
Yeah, so during the lockdown, my friend Thomas Strong, who is a lecturer with the anthropology department at NUI Maynooth, got in touch with me to say that he was writing this report and that there had been provision in his research for a kind of front-facing community engagement, which was probably going to take the form of an academic conference. But of course, then when the lockdown happened, you know, it was looking like that was probably going to have to be another Zoom situation, which he just didn't think, you know, was...
Who wants another Zoom call?
Yeah. So he kind of approached me and just said, can you conceive of something that we might be able to do with this funding? And I had been making live shows that were kind of like mixed bill queer variety shows and, you know, sort of had seen a lot of content that people had been making for digital platforms during the lockdown, and was kind of interested because it seemed like there was a different, something different was going on there, because a lot of people who maybe had never conceived of making, you know, work for the internet or for YouTube were bringing
suddenly
all of
doing
these
that.
New sensibilities. Yeah. So, you know, when the funding presented itself, I was like, okay, if I'm going to make something, I want it to be... you know, I want people to get properly paid, and I feel like it needs to be well produced, because when you put stuff up online,
it's
you know,
there
you're immediately competing with like everything else that people can watch on the internet.
Now, at one level, the academic research here is, and with no disrespect to your friend Thomas at all, but when we, you know, when we read Culture and Sexual Risk, an ethnographic analysis of gay male sexual wars in Ireland today, we know that's an academic study.
Uh-huh.
Now, you wanted to take that, I think, and make it perhaps more accessible in a theatrical, in a filmic type of way. Is that what the idea behind the various characters who we meet in Shameless? Because we meet a series of characters, really.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it was... I'm always kind of really interested in, like, how would you say, like uneasy bedfellows. Things, you know, putting different things in context together that you think wouldn't necessarily work, but in a strange way that they do. And I feel like that's, you know, part of what it is to kind of queer something when you use it as a verb. You know, it's when things rub up against each other that, you know, produce surprising results. Or when you make something strange. So, you know, I suppose the process for me was looking at, you know, Tom would show me different summaries of his findings from the report, and then I would kind of like imagine how I might be able to apply that to the kind of work that I make, which is usually in a live context, you know, on stage or, you know, in bars, or I work in nightlife as well. And then I would sort of, you know, there were sort of key themes that were coming out of the research for me. And then I approached the various different performers and we had a conversation
around how
they might conceive of, you know, the idea of, say, gay male respectability. You know, there was a lot of stuff in the findings about this culture of respectability that kind of came after marriage equality. And
yeah, because one of the things, let's have a listen to a clip that features Carl Hayden, and Carl is kind of, in some ways, he gives us the context for these various different performances, if you like. Mm-hmm. I think if you're Stefan Faye as a kind of performance of a character who maybe is exemplifying some of the discussions that are there. And we should warn that obviously the topics that have been dealt with here are sexually frank, and some of the discussions are very explicit in terms of what the various sexual activities that are involved. But in this particular case, Carl is describing Boiler House, what the Boiler House was. It's a sauna, essentially. It's a sauna, or as it's referred to at one point along the way, a sex on premises venue is the nice words that are used to describe it.
A gentleman's health club, it's also been called.
Okay. Well, let's have Carl's version of that.
Saunas have been a feature of the gay community in Ireland for a lot longer than most people would even know. The sauna culture in Ireland really kicked off in 1981 when the gym opened in Dame Lane. It was a venue for men who weren't in a position to be able to go into the gay scene, limited in all as it was at that time, but where they could go and meet other men to have sex. It was safer than going out to parks, car parks, open spaces where they were vulnerable to being beaten up, to being blackmailed. And so a culture began to grow. We've had a number of gay saunas, particularly in Dublin, over the last 30, 40 years. There's the gym, there's Incognito, there's the Vortex out in the Liffey. These spaces for these men were very important because of the protection that it gave them. It also helped them build friendships, sometimes in the sense of family that they didn't have outside of these places, outside of the places where they lived, outside of the homes that they lived in.
And that's Carl Herdin there speaking about a boiler house at the Dublin Sauna. With me in studio this evening is Stephen Quinn, who is the director of the film Shameless. The word shame occurs an awful lot. I think it's an hour and 8, an hour and 10 minutes, something like that. Stephen, the word shame is probably the one we hear more than any other.
Yeah, well, I think unfortunately that's still very much part of the queer experience, or certainly the experience of gay men in this country. Mm. We're still, you know, obviously we've made leaps and bounds in terms of legislation, in terms of social attitudes over the last couple of decades. But unfortunately, I think we still have a lot to unpack in terms of trauma, shame, and all of the, you know, all of the things that come with that.
I'm guessing too that in some ways part of the idea in both the research and indeed in your film is to fight stereotypes. And one of the stereotypes would be, oh, a group of gay men in a sauna. That in itself is almost a stereotype. How did you feel about portraying that on screen, and did you want to fight that stereotype around the sauna?
Well, funnily enough, where the idea of shooting the film in the sauna came from was, in the late 1960s, early 1970s, there was a sauna, a gentleman's health club, in the Astoria Hotel in New York City, where Bette Midler, a very young Bette Midler, used to perform when she was like 19 or 20, and Barry Manilow, who was also then kind of unknown, neither of them had had their break at this point, they used to perform in this sauna. So, you know, men would go there and they would be, you know, in towels, and it was a social context. I mean, people went there to have sex as well, of course. And there was a performance space in this sauna where Bette Midler would go. And she's kind of said that, you know, this was a very formative experience for her and in terms of her stage persona. So I just loved that idea, you know, the idea of having a cabaret in this space that is like uncompromising in terms of certain parts of our experiences as gay men, you know. So I wanted the piece to be sort of, for sure, to kind of challenge stereotypes, but I think it's like, it's a lot of different things, you know. It's quite dark. I hope it's quite funny and entertaining, and, you know, there's no one, each segment is
different,
sort of,
yeah,
could stand alone, and you could expand
are several characters within it. We don't have time to discuss all of them, but your own Stephen Fay is the one that kind of leads us through quite a lot of the film. Yeah, he's the MC of the piece. The piece is called Shameless, and Stephen Quinn with me speaking about it this evening. It'll be shown tomorrow night in the Town Hall Theatre in Galway as part of the Galway Film Fla, and you can find out full details on galwayfilmfla.com.